If you dig the twisted, admire the outlandish, and are enamored by the unusual, you're in the right place. True crime, the supernatural, the unexplained, now you're speaking our language. If you agree, join us as we dive into the darker side. You know, because it's more fun over here. Welcome to Total Conundrum.
Warning, some listeners may find the following content disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, Conundrum crew, buckle up. Today, we're heading out into the middle of San Francisco Bay to a place that's soaked in fog, fear, and a whole lot of unfinished business. We're talking about one of the most infamous spots in American history, Alcatraz Island.
Yeah, The Rock. Not the Dwayne Johnson kind. We're talking cold concrete, steel bars, and the kind of place that was built to break people. And what makes Alcatraz different from every other prison? It's not just the criminals. It's everything around them. The setting, the escapes, the myths, and the ghosts.
And trust us, there are a lot of ghost stories. Some of them are based on real encounters. Some are whispered from tourist to tourist. And some, they're documented by full-on paranormal investigators. We're going to dig into all of it. Everything from the island's earliest days as a military outpost to the inmates who lived and died here and maybe never left.
There's a reason this place has inspired so many movies, books, and ghost shows. It's not just the crumbling old prison. Alcatraz is layered. It's got this eerie energy to it. Part history, part tragedy, and part something else that people can't quite explain.
We're going to walk you through the whole story, from its origins in the 1800s to housing some of the most notorious names in American crime. We'll break down the escape attempts, especially the one that still has people wondering if those guys actually made it out alive.
And of course, we'll dive headfirst into the hauntings, because even after it shut down in 1963, something about Alcatraz just didn't rest. There are hundreds of reports, guards, visitors, ghost hunters who claim they've seen and heard things that just don't make sense. Strange voices, cold spots, full apparitions, banjo music in an empty shower room. I mean, come on.
We'll also talk about the Native American occupation in the late 60s, which turned Alcatraz into a symbol of protest and activism. That part of the story often gets left out, but it's just as powerful. And honestly, it adds even more weight to the energy on that island.
So whether you're here for the history, the hauntings, or just hoping we say something dumb about the ghosts in prison uniforms, welcome. You're in the right place.
If you've ever been to Alcatraz or have had a weird experience there, we want to hear from you. Hit us up on our socials or send us a message. Maybe we'll even feature your story on a future episode.
All right, let's grab our flashlights and step through the gate. Next stop, the fog-covered fortress that's been messing with people for over a century.
This is The Rock Unraveled. Hauntings, history, and escapes of Alcatraz. Let's get into it.
So before this place ever held a single prisoner, before the name Alcatraz sent chills down anyone's spine, it was just a rock. Literally, a small jagged island out in the middle of the San Francisco Bay. But it didn't stay just a rock for long.
Back in the late 1700s, Spanish explorers were the first Europeans to chart the island. One of them, Juan Manuel de Ayala, named it La Isla de los Alcatraces, which translates to the Island of Pelicans. At the time, it was uninhabited and covered in, you guessed it, seabirds. It was remote, surrounded by powerful currents, and it had an eerie kind of isolation even then.
The U.S. government took notice of that isolation almost immediately. After California became part of the Union, we're talking early 1850s, right around the Gold Rush era, San Francisco was exploding with people, And with that came money, crime, and vulnerability. Suddenly, this little island in the bay had strategic value.
In 1853, construction began on the military fortress. Thick walls, cannons, a huge defensive structure meant to guard the bay from foreign invaders. It was essentially a coastal stronghold. And right alongside it, in 1854, they built the very first lighthouse on the West Coast. That's a little detail that gets glossed over sometimes, but it's pretty significant. It shows how early the government prioritized this island, not just for the defense, but for navigation too.
Which makes sense. San Francisco Bay was, and still is, one of the busiest ports on the West Coast. Having a lighthouse there in the mid-1800s was crucial for keeping incoming ships from slamming into the island, especially with all that heavy fog.
By the 1860s, the Alcatraz started shifting from a military fort to something darker. During the Civil War, the Army started using it to hold political prisoners and Confederate sympathizers. That's when it quietly started becoming a prison.
And it didn't stop there. Over the next few decades, the fortress lost some of its strategic importance as military technology evolved. But the island's ability to keep people in became a new claim to fame. In 1907, Alcatraz was officially designated as a military prison.
And it wasn't just for wartime detainees. Over time, they started sending soldiers there for desertion, insubordination, theft, and basically anything else the army deemed unacceptable. A lot of these guys weren't hardened criminals. They were just people who screwed up or resisted authority and ended up on a rock in the middle of nowhere.
And we're talking about a place that was still pretty bare bones back then. The buildings were old. The cells weren't modern or comfortable in any way. This was early 20th century punishment, isolation, hard labor, and a lot of time to reflect. The idea was to break you down, strip away the rebellion, and send you back to duty.
So it's kind of wild to think that Alcatraz didn't start as a prison for the country's worst criminals. It originally was a symbol of protection, a coastal shield, and then it gradually morphed into a place of containment. A place built to keep people out became a place built to keep people in.
Exactly. It's like the whole identity of the island shifted with the country's priorities. First, it was about defending from outside threats. Then it became about locking up internal ones.
There's also something kind of eerie about how isolated it was. Even before it was a prison, Alcatraz had the reputation for being unwelcoming. Between the jagged shoreline and the unpredictable water currents and the relentless wind, it just didn't feel like a place meant for people to stay. Even the wildlife was like, yeah, we're out.
Yeah, and if you go there today, that vibe still lingers. The building may be worn down and tourist-filled now, but that old energy, it's like it's baked into the stone.
And even in the early days, there were stories, rumors from the soldiers stationed there about the silence being oppressive and the fog swallowing sound in a way that messed with their heads. It's not hard to imagine how those early military residents might have felt like they were already living in kind of a ghost story.
Which makes the next chapter in Alcatraz's story feel almost inevitable. You've got the isolated island already functioning as a prison with a reputation for breaking people down. So when the federal government needed a place to house the worst of the worst, bank robbers, gangsters, escape artists, well, the Rock was waiting.
And that's where we're headed next. The transformation from a military prison into the most feared federal penitentiary in America. The Alcatraz that makes headlines, inspires legends, and leaves people wondering if it was ever truly empty, even after all the inmates were gone.
Stick with us, because this is where the myth really begins to take shape.
All right, so let's fast forward to 1934. That's when Alcatraz officially became a federal penitentiary. At this point, the military was done with it, and the Department of Justice saw an opportunity.
The country was in the middle of the Great Depression. The crime, especially organized crime, was a massive issue. You had gangsters pulling off bank robberies, bootlegging, extortion, and a lot of these guys were getting too comfortable escaping from regular prisons.
So the government needed a place to send the guys who just couldn't be contained. Not necessarily the most violent criminals, but the ones who were most disruptive and most escape prone, or the ones who kept causing chaos in other prisons. Alcatraz wasn't built for rehabilitation. It was built to isolate.
That's something people still get wrong. They think Alcatraz was where you went if you were the worst of the worst. But really, it was where you went if you were the biggest pain in the ass for the prison system. If you'd escaped before, tried to start riots, refused to follow the rules, that's where you landed, right here.
The prison was designed with one goal, total control. One man per cell, no group housing, no physical contact with other inmates. You were locked down for 23 hours a day in a 5x9 foot concrete box. Meals were eaten in silence. There was no parole offered. Alcatraz wasn't just a prison. It was a dead end.
And the island itself added another layer of psychological pressure. Just a little over a mile from the San Francisco shoreline, so close you could literally see freedom. But you were stuck. The frigid water, deadly currents, and sharp rocks made swimming out basically a suicide mission.
The guards called it the prison system's prison. You didn't go directly to Alcatraz. You earned your way there by acting up somewhere else. It was a punishment for being a problem, not necessarily a psychopath.
But that doesn't mean the roster wasn't stacked with some of the most famous names in criminal history. You had guys here who were basically legends even before they arrived.
Let's start with the most obvious one, Al Capone, probably the most famous inmate to ever do time in Alcatraz. He was transferred there in 1934, right when the place opened up. Up to that point, Capone had been living pretty comfortably in other prisons, pulling strings, bribing guards, even running his operation from behind bars.
But that all changed when he got to the Rock. Alcatraz stripped him of his power. No outside communication, no bribes, no special treatment, and that broke him fast. He started to mentally deteriorate from the isolation and from the advanced syphilis that was attacking his brain.
He ended up spending most of his time either in the prison hospital or in protective isolation. There's even a story that towards the end of his sentence, Capone spent many hours playing the banjo in the prison shower room because it was one of the only places he could be alone.
Next up, George Machine Gun Kelly. He was another high-rolling profile case. Inmate famous for kidnapping and bootlegging in prison. Though he didn't live up to the hype, according to guards, he was quiet, cooperative, kind of average. No shootouts or tough guy stuff.
Then there's Robert Stroud, better known as the Birdman of Alcatraz. But here's the twist. He never actually kept birds on Alcatraz. That all happened at Leavenworth before he was transferred. By the time he got to the Rock, he was too dangerous and unpredictable to be allowed near animals, or people, really. He was kept in total isolation in the prison hospital wing.
He was super intelligent, though, even wrote scientific papers on bird diseases. But he was also violent. He'd killed a guard at Leavenworth, and that's why he was sent to Alcatraz in the first place.
One of the most long-term inmates was Elvin Creepy Carpus. He was the last public enemy number one to be captured and ended up spending over 25 years at Alcatraz, longest time served there. He was reportedly very intelligent and low drama, one of the few inmates who didn't lose it mentally over the years.
Carpus even claimed that the FBI director J. Edgar Hoover personally arrested him, which was a rare thing. That guy was kind of a legend in criminal circles and in FBI nightmares.
There were also guys like Mickey Cohen, the Hollywood mobster who ran rackets in LA and claimed to know everyone in show business. He hated being at Alcatraz, said it was the most miserable place he'd ever been.
And then there was the lesser known guys like Henry Young, who became the subject of a Hollywood film in the 90s. He was supposedly thrown into solitary confinement for years after trying to escape. And the story painted Alcatraz as this brutal, dehumanizing place. Some of that was exaggerated for the movie, but the core of it, guys being broken mentally, wasn't far off.
That's something worth emphasizing. A lot of men didn't survive Alcatraz psychologically. Even if they made it through physically, the silence, the isolation, the boredom, it wore people down. Some committed suicide, some went mad, and some claimed that they were never alone in their cells. Ooh.
Which we're going to circle back to later when we talk about the hauntings. But even without the ghost stories, the vibes in that place was heavy. Even guards reported feeling it, like the building itself held on to pain.
And it wasn't just the inmates who had to live with it. Guards lived on the island with their families. There was a whole community, kids, spouses, staff, all trying to live a normal life just a few hundred feet from America's most infamous criminals.
Imagine doing your homework while Capone is losing his mind down the hill.
Yeah. Hey, Dad, can I go for a stroll? Sure. Just don't talk to the guy who used to run Chicago. Totally normal.
But seriously, that setup created this strange contrast. This island of discipline, isolation, and punishment. And then, just around the corner, a playground.
And that kind of weird, layered atmosphere is something that really never left this place. Even now, when it's a tourist destination, people step off that ferry and they feel it. The weight and the history. And for some, maybe even something more.
That's coming up. But first, we've got to talk about the people who didn't stay locked in. The ones who tried to get out. Some of them failed spectacularly. And some, well, they might have made it. But we'll never know.
Time to dig into the escape attempts. So now that we've talked about who ended up on Alcatraz, let's talk about what daily life actually looked like on the inside. Spoiler, it wasn't exactly inspiring personal growth or rehabilitation.
Nope. Alcatraz wasn't a place where you got a second chance. It was a place where you disappeared into routine. And that routine was strict, intentionally. So every hour of every day was scheduled, watched, and controlled.
Inmates woke up at 6:30 a.m. and had to immediately make their beds to regulation standards. Not just neat, we're talking hospital corner perfection. They got dressed, cleaned their cells, and lined up for the first of three silent meals.
And we mean silent. Talking during meals wasn't just frowned upon. It was against the rules. The dining hall was probably one of the tensest places in the prison. Guards sat in elevated, armed observation posts, and there were tear gas canisters rigged to the ceiling in case of a riot breaking out. The moment things felt off, they could flood the entire room with gas in seconds. Just like me!
More like what Harley did last night. He had a loaded cannon in that doggy butt.
Machine gun Harley.
It was a dangerous movie activity last night.
Don't move.
Don't breathe, more like it. Well, after meals, the rest of the day was filled with labor assignments, laundry, sewing, making gloves for the military, or stamping out license plates. The prison had multiple industrial buildings for that kind of work. And while it sounded like a grind, some inmates preferred to stay busy. It helped keep their minds off isolation.
There were some perks for good behavior. You could get library privileges, spend a little bit more time in the yard, maybe even get a job with slightly less supervision. But any step out of line and you were back in your cell, or worse, solitary.
And speaking of the library, here's something that really surprised me. The reading culture on Alcatraz was huge. Some inmates reportedly read up to 75 to 100 books a year. That's one of the few escapes available for them. Books, fiction, nonfiction, legal texts, you name it.
Every inmate had access to a catalog of books and could request titles through a prison librarian. They'd read in their cells, often for hours. They would shut out the walls and the silence. It was one of the few things they could control.
But even with reading, even with routines, the isolation still got to people. Remember, this was a place designed to strip you of any influence or identity you had before you came in. No talking in the halls, no contact visits, and almost no privacy.
Even the cells themselves were more psychological than physical punishment. Just big enough for a bed and a toilet and a small desk and a sink. The walls echoed. They could hear people cough from three cells down. At night, the wind outside would rattle the bars and the windows like something was trying to claw its way in.
And over time, that kind of environment does something to a person. There were numerous reports of inmates suffering mental breakdowns. Some went completely catatonic. Others grew paranoid, started hallucinating, and a few became violent with no clear trigger.
There were suicides too. A number of inmates ended their lives on the rock. Some by hanging, others by slashing their wrists with makeshift blades or trying to overdose on smuggled medication. And that was with constant surveillance. It's a reminder of how desperate people became.
One of the eeriest parts of the prison was the hospital wing, located directly above the dining hall. It was a long, sterile hallway with metal frame beds and white tile floors. It's where they sent inmates with serious physical or mental health issues.
Both Al Capone and Robert Strout spent time up there. Capone was in and out frequently due to his worsening syphilis symptoms. Hallucinations, confusion, paranoia. Strout was essentially kept up there in permanent medical isolation because he was too dangerous to interact with other inmates.
And then, of course, you had the quote-unquote treatment cells, a nice euphemism for solitary confinement. Those were the real deal. No light, no mattress, no contact, just concrete and the sound of your own thoughts. Or whatever else you thought you might have heard.
Yeah, these are the stories, real ones, from guards and inmates alike, about guys who went into solitary and came out completely different, talking to themselves, shaking, eyes wide, like they'd seen something no one else could see.
That's the part that starts to blur the line between psychological collapse and something less explainable. Like, was it the stress of being alone for 24 hours a day? Or was there actually something in those cells?
You know what they say. When you strip a person of sound, color, contact, and time, the mind fills the silence with whatever it can. Sometimes it fills it with memories, sometimes with hallucinations, and sometimes maybe with something else entirely.
We'll dig into that more in our haunting section, but it's important to note the breakdown of sanity wasn't rare on Alcatraz. It was expected. The place was practically designed for it.
And it wasn't just the inmates feeling the weight of all of it. Guards reported it too. Some quit early. Some transferred out after less than a year. And remember, these guys were trained to be tough, emotionally distant. Even they couldn't always shake the heaviness of the place.
One of the creepiest contrasts, right outside the cell blocks, you had family housing for the guards, literally homes, little gardens, kids playing, holiday decorations, all of it just a short walk from some of the most notorious prisoners in America.
Can you imagine waking up and sending your kid to school while down the hill, a guy who kidnapped and murdered a federal agent is eating breakfast in silence?
It's like the weirdest version of a gated community ever. And it just adds to how strange and layered Alcatraz really was. This wasn't just a prison. It was an island with two completely different worlds trying to function side by side.
And over time, even when the routines held, even when the prisoners behaved, the tensions never really went away. It sat in the walls. You can still feel it now when you walk those cell blocks.
Which might be why some people say the rock never really shut down. Maybe the inmates left. Maybe the guards packed up. But the energy, the stories, they stuck around.
Coming up next, we'll get into the ones who tried to beat the system. The ones who stared out across the cold, dark bay and thought, I can make it.
Alcatraz was called escape-proof, but that didn't stop people from trying. Some failed, some vanished, and a few might have made it to the other side. So, we've talked about the walls, the routines, the mind-numbing repetition of the life on the rock, but even with the isolation, even with the freezing bay water and the towering guard towers, people still tried to escape. A lot of them, actually.
Yeah, between 1934 and 1963, there were 14 documented escape attempts involving 36 men. That's more than you'd expect for a place that was supposedly escape-proof.
And to be clear, none of these guys just walked out. Every attempt involved serious planning, patience, and usually a pretty wild amount of desperation.
Out of the 36, 23 were caught, 6 were shot and killed during the attempt, and 2 drowned. But that leaves 5 men who were never found. And that's where things really get interesting.
Let's start with the one everyone knows, the 1962 escape that inspired books, documentaries, and even a Clint Eastwood movie, The Escape of Frank Morris and the brothers John and Clarence Anglin.
This wasn't some spur-of-the-moment thing. These guys spent months planning it. Frank Morris was known to be highly intelligent. Some reports even put his IQ in the top 2% of the prison population. And the Anglin brothers? They were skilled at getting out of tight situations, literally.
So here's how they did it, or at least how we think they did it. Each man had a vent in the back of his cell, and slowly, over time, they chipped away at the edges using homemade tools, a spoon, a metal file, even a piece of sharpened wood. They concealed their progress with cardboard and paint so it looked like nothing was disturbed.
Behind the vent was an unguarded service corridor. They used to move between the cells and a makeshift workshop they built in a hidden area above the cell block.
In that workshop, they assembled a raft made out of 50 stolen raincoats, along with life vests, a makeshift paddle, and other supplies. And the final touch? They made paper mache heads, complete with real human hair from the prison barber, and propped them up on their pillows to fool the guards during bed checks.
On the night of June 11th, 1962, the three men escaped through the vents, climbed to the roof, made their way down the pipes at the side of the building, and carried their raft to the water's edge. By the next morning, they were gone, and the prison was in full lockdown mode.
But what most people don't really talk about is that there was actually a fourth man in on the plan, Alan West. He helped them with everything, digging, constructing, gathering materials, but on the night of the escape, he couldn't make it out of his vent in time.
Right? He had chiseled through the concrete wall behind his cell with the tools they made from spoons and a vacuum cleaner motor. But it wasn't wide enough. By the time he got it open, the others were already gone. He never left that night.
And later, Wes cooperated with the FBI. He gave them full details about the plan, the dummy heads, the homemade tools, the crawl space above their cells. Without his confession, a lot of what we know about how they escaped might have stayed a mystery.
Some people think West made up part of it to get leniency, but most of it checked out. It's wild to think. He helped mastermind the whole thing and got left behind. Imagine what that night felt like, stuck in your cell while your partners vanished into the dark.
The prison and the FBI launched an immediate manhunt. They found some paddle fragments, a makeshift life vest, and pieces of the raft washed up on Angel Island, but they never found the men, no bodies, and no confirmed sightings.
The official line has always been that they likely drowned in the bay. The water that night was around 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and the current was brutal. But then, there's the photo.
Decades later, in 2013, a photograph surfaced that appeared to show the Anglin brothers alive in Brazil, taken in the late 70s. The photo was given to investigators by a family friend of the Anglins who claimed the brothers had fled to South America and had been living under the radar ever since.
And get this, facial recognition tech couldn't disprove the photo. It wasn't a slam dunk confirmation, but it raised enough questions that the FBI kept the case open until 2013, when it was officially closed, but still unsolved.
We'll be back after these messages. Hey, Conundrum Crew. Have you ever listened to an episode and thought, wow, I wish I could wear this level of chaos?
Well, now you can. That's right. Total Conundrum officially has merch.
Hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, everything you need to rep your favorite mystery-loving, banter-filled podcast in style.
And the best part? Our signature cute pink brain is front and center, scratching its head just like the rest of us, trying to figure out life's weirdest mysteries.
Honestly, it's the perfect representation of our show. Smart, a little confused, and totally adorable.
Just like me! Yeah!
Sure, Jeremy. Let's go with that.
Anyways, if you want to grab your official Total Conundrum merch, head to bonfire.com/store/total-conundrum and get yourself something spooky, stylish, and absolutely conundrum worthy.
Because nothing solves a mystery quite like retail therapy.
Available now while supplies last. And back to the show.
And it's not just the photo. Their family has said for years that they received Christmas cards, phone calls, and even had people show up at funerals claiming to know where the brothers were. So, was it a hoax? Or did they actually make it?
To this day, it's one of the biggest unsolved mysteries in American criminal history. The Anglin escape wasn't just clever. It's the only one that might have actually worked.
But they weren't the only ones that got close.
There were also John Paul Scott, who made his escape later the same year, in December 1962. He actually swam from Alcatraz to the San Francisco shore, something that was long believed to be impossible.
Scott squeezed through a kitchen window, slid down a drain pipe, and jumped into the bay with water temperatures in the mid-50s. And get this, he made it all the way to Fort Point, underneath the Golden Gate Bridge.
Unfortunately for him, when he got there, he was so hypothermic and exhausted that he collapsed on the rocks. A couple of teenagers found him and called the police. He was arrested right there and sent back to Alcatraz.
But that swim proved something. The distance could be done. It wasn't sharks or sea monsters stopping people. It was cold. The water temperature and the current were the real killers. If you weren't trained for it, you were toast in minutes.
That's one of the biggest myths people still believe about Alcatraz, that the bay was shark infested. In reality, the sharks in the area are mostly small bottom feeders, not man eaters. The real danger was hypothermia and exhaustion.
And while most escapees were caught or killed, the mere fact that dozens of people tried says a lot about the mindset in that place. Even when the odds are stacked to the ceiling, some men looked at that water and thought, I'd rather die trying.
There's something primal about that. The rock was the end of the road. If you believed that, then escaping wasn't just an act of rebellion. It was the last shot at dignity, even if it meant drowning.
And I think that's why the escape attempts are still so fascinating, because they weren't just about physically getting out. They were about mentally resisting the complete loss of control.
And maybe that's why the stories have stuck around for so long. Even now, people walk through those cell blocks and stare at the same vents Morris and the Anglins crawled through, and they wonder, did they really make it? Did they really paddle across in the dark and disappear into a new life?
Or did the bay swallow them up and keep the secret?
Either way, they left behind something more powerful than a body or a file. They left a story, a mystery, and on an island that seems built to trap things, not just people, but energy and history, the mystery still floats out there.
And maybe that lingering uncertainty is part of why so many people say the place still feels inhabited, not by prisoners, not by guards, but by all those unfinished stories.
And that brings us to the most active part of Alcatraz's history, the paranormal activity.
Up next, we're diving into the hauntings, the ghost stories, the investigations that have tried to answer one very big question. Is Alcatraz still alive in some other way? All right, Conundrum Crew, you've heard the stories of the inmates, the guards, the impossible escape attempts, but now we're getting into what might be the most compelling and definitely the most chilling part of the Alcatraz story, the hauntings.
Yeah, even if you don't believe in ghosts, something about that place gets under your skin. The silence in those cell blocks, the way sound bounces around and seems to come from nowhere, it messes with you. You don't need flickering lights or spooky music. Alcatraz brings its own atmosphere.
And it's not just the tourists getting creeped out. For decades, former guards, prison staff, and even some inmates have reported things that they couldn't explain. Sounds, shadows, voices, cold spots, feelings of being watched. The stories go back way before ghost hunting was trendy.
Let's break it down by the hot spots, because some parts of the prison are way more active than others. And the top of the list, cell 14D.
This cell is one of the most talked about locations on the island. It was used for solitary confinement, and it's completely cut off from light. Just pitch black and silence, sometimes for days.
Even back in the prison's active days, guards said they hated sending people into 14D. Not because it wasn't effective, but because men came out different. Some refused to speak. Some were terrified. Some swore they weren't alone in there.
Modern visitors say the same thing. Cold air pockets, like a sudden drop of 20 degrees, growling noises with no source, heavy pressure on their chest like something invisible is sitting on them, and not everyone can even stay inside. Some people walk in, stand there for a few seconds, and immediately noped their way out.
There's even one old prison record about an inmate screaming from inside 14D that something with glowing eyes was in there with him. The next day, he was found dead. The official cause was ruled heart failure, but the guards on duty, they weren't so sure.
If cell 14D is where the spirits make themselves known, the hospital wing is where they linger. This is the part of the prison that feels most inhabited, even now.
It's tucked away above the dining hall, where inmates with illnesses or mental health issues were treated or locked away. It's also where Capone and Stroud spent most of their time, and it's probably the one section where even tour guides admit they don't like to stay long.
Visitors report ghostly figures near the operating tables, unexplained whispers, and bursts of cold wind even when no windows are open. One tour guide claimed to hear the distant dragging sound of something being pulled across the floor, but no one was there. And when she looked around, the gurney she passed earlier had moved.
You have to remember, this is where inmates died. This is where pain was treated, but also where it was contained, sometimes without much compassion. The energy in there is heavy, like something just hasn't moved on.
The warden's house once sat right above the prison grounds, basically a full family home with the views of the San Francisco Bay. It burned down in a fire in 1970, but even now, people claim to still see shadows in the windows or hear footsteps walking across the floorboards of a building that technically isn't there anymore.
And the gun galley, which overlooked the cell blocks, has its own reports, footsteps when no one's around, and the clink of keys and the unmistakable sound of a metal gate opening, even though it's long been sealed shut.
This one always gets me. Multiple people have reported hearing banjo music echoing through the old shower room area, which is weird enough on its own until you realize Al Capone used to play his banjo in there.
Yeah, near the end of his sentence, Capone was mentally and physically deteriorating. He wasn't allowed in general population anymore, and he could only practice his music alone in the showers. That's how isolated he'd become.
Some say his spirit never left that space. It's not loud or theatrical. It's just a quiet plucking sound that drifts through the air and vanishes the moment you try to chase it.
Look, if I hear a ghost banjo music echoing in the dark, abandoned prison shower, I'm not running. I'm grabbing a flashlight and finding who's playing it. If it's Capone, we're jamming. If it's not, well, at least I have a story to tell.
Let's be honest. I'm probably running the other way.
True.
Yes. All right. Let's talk investigations, because this isn't just ghost stories passed around in the dark. Major paranormal teams have been on Alcatraz, and some of them walked away with seriously weird stuff.
Ghost Adventures did a full episode on Alcatraz and reported one of their strongest reactions ever in Cell 14D. Crew members experienced sudden dizziness. One guy swore something touched his back, and they captured EVPs that said something like, "Help me and get out."
Ghost hunters took a more technical approach. EMF meters, thermal imaging, voice recorders. They logged sudden temperature drops, unexplained whispers, and even caught a shadow figure passing through the hospital wing on infrared.
BuzzFeed Unsolved visited too. They brought their usual skeptic versus believer vibe. But even the skeptic admitted hearing unexplained noises in D Block, which has some of the oldest cells on the island.
And Most Haunted Live, the UK team, spent 3 nights investigating Alcatraz. They reported emotional spikes, crew members experiencing breakdowns, and EVP responses in multiple areas, especially in the isolation cells.
All right, let's break down what's actually been captured on record over the years, because it's not just ghost tour gossip. Some of this stuff, it's on tape, caught by investigators and even tourists with no idea what they were walking into.
Right? This isn't just a flashlight and creaky floorboard kind of thing. These are consistent reports from people who had no reason to fake it, and some didn't even realize that they caught something until after the fact.
First up, disembodied voices, crystal clear audio. We're talking stuff like, "Get out. Don't." And he's watching. And these were caught in supposedly empty cell blocks, sometimes even during daytime tours.
And they're not always angry sounding either. Some are just eerie, quiet, like someone's watching but doesn't want to be seen, which, let's be honest, is way worse.
Then we've got EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, visitors, amateur ghost hunters, even guides have picked up strange static-laced messages. A few are garbled, but some are very specific. Whispers of inmates' names, repeated numbers, almost like roll call from beyond.
And those old prison numbers weren't public knowledge either. So when one of them shows up on a recording, yeah, that sends chills down your spine.
Next, apparitions. Tourists have snapped photos with figures standing in doorways or peeking out from cell windows. But when they check again, no one's there. No guards, no reenactors, nothing.
And not just one-off flukes either. Multiple people, different days, different angles. It's like the rock is still occupied, just not by the living.
Last one's kind of underrated, but it gets reported a lot. Phantom smells. Cigar smoke in sealed off areas, the stench of gunpowder in the air, or the sharp, clean scent of soap near the showers, where nobody's been for decades. Nothing visible, no source, just scent and dread.
And scent is one of the strongest ties to memory, right? So maybe what we're smelling isn't physical at all. Maybe it's emotional residue, trauma that left a trace. One of the creepiest claims: a visitor on a night tour said they smelt cigar smoke and saw a shadow of a man wearing a hat step into a cell and vanish.
Either way, the place has a pulse, just not the kind you measure with a watch.
All right, Jeremy, honest answer. If you saw that glowing-eyed figure from cell 14D staring you down from the hallway, are you standing your ground or are you getting out of there?
Oh, I'm out. No questions, no second glances, glowing eyes in a solitary cell. That's not a ghost. That's a hard no for me. I don't dance with the devil.
So not even a, "Hey, buddy, do you need help crossing over?"
Nope, that guy doesn't want help. He wants company, and I'm not volunteering my time.
Okay, well, then let's play a little Would You Rather. Would you rather spend 3 hours alone in cell 14D or do a solo walk through the hospital wing with night vision goggles?
Ugh, that's not fair. I feel like the hospital wing's got ghost patients, but cell 14D's got flaming hot Cheeto devil that's ready to take my soul back to Georgia. I'm picking the hospital wing. At least then I feel like my soul will be safe from the devil demon in cell 14D.
What about you guys? Listener poll time. If you had to spend one night in a haunted section of Alcatraz, would you pick cell 14D, the hospital wing, the warden's house, the showers? Let us know on socials. We'll share the results in a future episode. Whether you believe in ghosts or not, Alcatraz has a way of making people feel things. It's cold. It's loud when it shouldn't be. It's quiet when it should be loud. Something about it stays with people. It's not just the history, it's the energy.
And maybe that's why the stories haven't stopped, because some parts of the rock still want to be heard.
So far, we've covered some of the darkest corners of Alcatraz: ghosts, isolation, madness. But we haven't talked about what is hands down one of the most violent moments in the island's history.
Yeah, this one is different. It wasn't a quiet haunting or a slow unraveling of someone's mind. This was loud, explosive, bloody. This was the Battle of Alcatraz.
It happened in May of 1946, and it all started with a group of inmates who were done playing by the rules. Six of them hatched a plan: take over the cell house, grab weapons, and break out. It was bold. It was desperate. And it went off the rails almost immediately.
The main guy behind it was Bernard Coy. He was a bank robber and, more importantly, a keen observer. He'd been studying guard routines, security flaws, and even timing when the gun gallery was unguarded. He noticed mesh in the gallery wasn't bulletproof, just steel bars. That was his opening.
On May 2nd, he and five other inmates, Marvin Hubbard, Joseph Kreitzer, Sam Shockley, Clarence Carnes, and Miriam Thompson, put their plan into motion. Coy squeezed through the bars of the gun gallery and overpowered a guard, grabbing a rifle, pistol, and keys.
They managed to take control of cell block C and part of cell block D, locking several guards in cells as hostages. But here's where it broke down. They couldn't find the right key to get into the recreation yard, which they needed to access the dock and eventually freedom.
Turns out, one of the guards they overpowered had hidden the yard key inside the toilet of his cell before handing over the rest. That single move might have prevented a total escape.
From there, things escalated fast. The inmates realized they were trapped. So instead of escaping, they dug in. They turned it into a standoff. For 2 days, they fought from inside of the prison, firing on guards and federal troops who were trying to regain control.
The warden called in the Marines, who dropped grenades through the holes that they drilled in the roof of the cell house. Gas grenades, explosives, a literal siege inside a U.S. federal prison.
By the end of it, two correctional officers were killed, dozens more were injured, and three of the six inmates were dead: Coy, Kreitzer, and Hubbard.
The remaining three, Shockley, Thompson, and Carnes, were captured. Carnes was only 19 and ended up getting a life sentence. The other two, Shockley and Thompson, were tried and executed at San Quentin in 1948 for their role in the officers' deaths.
And even today, the scars from the battle are still on the walls. Bullet holes are still seen in the concrete and metalwork of cell block C. They were never patched over as a reminder just how close the prison came to full collapse.
People who visit that wing often say the atmosphere there is different, like the air gets denser, like something's still playing out behind the scenes. And some even claim they hear gunshots echoing through the block long after the tour is over.
There's a theory among investigators and sensitives that trauma, especially extreme emotional events like this, can leave behind a kind of imprint. Not a ghost exactly, more like a psychic replay on a loop. And if that's true anywhere, it's probably true at Alcatraz.
Because the Battle of Alcatraz wasn't just an escape attempt gone wrong. It was a pressure cooker finally exploding. Years of frustration, violence, psychological torment, All of it boiled over in 48 hours of chaos and bloodshed.
And the rock, it held, barely, but it never really shook it off.
Coming up next, we're heading into another chapter of the island's history, one that didn't involve inmates or guards, but activists. In 1969, the island was reclaimed, not by violence, but by occupation.
We'll dive into how Alcatraz became a symbol of protest and cultural power in the movement that changed the country.
So after all the chaos, the ghosts, the escapes, and the history, Alcatraz didn't end in a dramatic final battle or some grand shutdown. It just slowly fell apart, literally.
The truth is, for as much as Alcatraz was designed to keep people in, it wasn't built to last forever. The island is surrounded by salt water, and over the years, that salt air ate away at everything. The pipes, the electrical systems, the plumbing, even the steel bars.
You had rusted pipes leaking behind the walls, heating systems constantly breaking down, and concrete flaking like old paint. By the early 1960s, the buildings were in rough shape. Maintenance became a full-time battle, and even then, it wasn't enough.
And the cost, it was staggering. Alcatraz cost around $10 per inmate per day to operate. Most other federal prisons at the time ran closer to $3 per inmate. That's more than triple the cost to house someone at Alcatraz, just to keep the place running.
Then there's the whole logistics nightmare. Since the island had no natural freshwater resources, every drop of water had to be shipped in by barge, along with all the food, supplies, fuel, and everything else. And then the waste shipped right back off, day after day, year after year.
It was like running a prison and a ferry service at the same time. Totally unsustainable.
So, by the early 60s, the writing was on the wall. The infrastructure was failing, the budget didn't make sense, and the public's perception of the prison system started to shift. Alcatraz just didn't fit anymore.
On March 21st, 1963, the prison officially closed. Inmates were transferred out. Guards and their families moved off the island. The gates were locked for good.
But the thing is, it didn't really feel like an ending. There was no ceremony, no press conference, no thanks for your service moment. It was quiet, almost like the island had just gone dormant.
And maybe it did, but just for a little while.
Because a few years later, something new would awaken on Alcatraz, a different kind of occupation, one not built on punishment or isolation, but on protest and reclaiming what was lost.
Coming up next, we dig into the Native American occupation of 1969, and a group of activists turned the rock into a symbol of resistance and indigenous power.
When most people think about Alcatraz, they think about the prison, the inmates, the guards, the ghosts. But there's a chapter in the island's history that has nothing to do with crime and punishment and everything to do with the protest and reclaiming identity.
Yeah, this part of the story doesn't get much mainstream attention, but it's one of the most powerful. In November of 1969, a group of Native American activists, mostly young people, students, occupied Alcatraz Island.
They called themselves the Indians of All Tribes. Their goal was simple but bold: to reclaim the land in accordance with a broken treaty. They cited the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, which stated that all abandoned federal land should be returned to the indigenous peoples who once lived on it. Alcatraz had been closed for 6 years. It was federal land, and it was sitting empty.
So on November 20th, 1969, about 80 activists landed on the island and claimed it as theirs. They made a formal declaration and began what would turn into a 19-month occupation, a peaceful protest meant to draw attention to centuries of broken treaties and mistreatment.
They didn't just plant a flag and sit around. They built a community. They created schools, kitchens, and a communications hub. They started a broadcast called Radio Free Alcatraz, which aired on Pacifica Radio and reached thousands of people around the country.
And they weren't alone. The movement gained national attention, and some high-profile names showed up in support. Jane Fonda visited, Marlon Brando sent supplies, and musicians like the Grateful Dead held benefit concerts to raise money for the occupation.
But it wasn't easy. The government cut off electricity. Supplies had to be boated in. There were internal tensions. Eventually, the numbers dwindled. And on June 11th, 1971, federal agents removed the remaining occupants.
But even though the occupation ended, it left a lasting impact. It became a major catalyst in the Red Power movement and inspired indigenous activism across the country. It also helped push forward policy changes, like the end of the Indian termination policy and the beginning of more tribal self-determination initiatives.
And some of what they left behind, it's still there. The graffiti phrases like "Welcome to Indian Land" was never fully scrubbed off. You can still see it when you visit. It's a visual reminder that this island wasn't just a place of punishment, it was also a place of protest.
There's something poetic about that. For more than 100 years, Alcatraz was a place where people were put to be forgotten. And in 1969, people showed up to make sure their history wouldn't be.
It flipped the script completely. It turned the rock into a symbol of resistance, of culture, and a voice. It wasn't about breaking out. It was about taking it back.
So while the prison may have closed in 1963, Alcatraz was far from silent, and it still had more chapters to write.
And that leads us into what it is today, a place of memory, of mystery, and of meaning. From fortress to prison to protest site, the Rock never really stopped evolving.
And even now, it's still pulling people in.
So we've traveled through the grim fortress days, the notorious inmates, ghost stories, even protest movements. But what's left of Alcatraz today?
Spoiler alert, it didn't sink into the bay or get demolished. In fact, it's more alive now than ever. Not with inmates, but with visitors, stories, and maybe the occasional ghost with a tour guide complex.
After the prison officially shut down in 1963, the island sat empty for almost a decade until 1972, when it folded into the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. That's when Alcatraz officially became a national park.
And that kicked off its second act, or maybe its third. Today, over 1 million people visit Alcatraz each year, which, if you think about it, is kind of wild. It went from housing the most unwanted people in the country to being one of the most in-demand tourist spots in the U.S.
You can take day tours, night tours, even audio-guided tours featuring the voices of former guards and inmates. The night tours especially, those are a whole different vibe. Just you, a flashlight, and the creak of old metal doors echoing around you.
And we're not just talking about historical tours. Alcatraz has become one of the platforms for art and activism. One of the most powerful examples of at-large expedition by Iwiwi in 2014.
Whoa. Pardon me? What was the name?
Iwiwi.
Oh my.
In 2014. An installation focused on the political prisoners and human rights spread through the prison cells in hospitals. You okay over there?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, you okay over there?
I'm thinking that poor man was, I'm assuming man.
Iwiwi.
What were his parents thinking?
Parlez-vous français.
Oh boy. Well, it's also been a major filming location over the years. I don't know if Iwiwi filmed there or not, but obviously you've got the escape.
I certainly didn't film my Iwiwi there.
Well, I sure hope not, or you'd be in big trouble, mister. Well, we've got the movies Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood in 1969, which I'm pretty sure he didn't film his wee wee there either. Then there's The Rock with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage blowing up half the island in the name of action movie justice.
And for the fantasy nerds out there, yes, J.K. Rowling has confirmed that Azkaban, the terrifying wizard prison in Harry Potter, was inspired by Alcatraz. The idea of a remote, stormy island with a soul-sucking presence, yeah, that tracks.
Beyond the books and blockbusters, Alcatraz has also become a place for reflection and remembrance. Memorials for the Native American occupation, interpretive exhibits about the island's layered past, and accessible programming that makes sure it's not just a dark curiosity, but a site of education and awareness.
The graffiti from the 1969 occupation still there. The cell blocks preserved. The hospital wing still creeps people out. And all of that is now protected. So the future generations can walk those same halls, feel those same chills, and maybe come away with a little more understanding of what Alcatraz really meant and still means.
So whether you're drawn by the history, the hauntings, or the hype, Alcatraz today is more than just the rock. It's a mirror. It reflects what we fear, what we remember, and how we move forward.
And it's still out there, sitting in the bay, watching the fog roll in, waiting for the next story.
All right. Well, Jeremy, from military fortress to haunted tourist traps, we just spent around an hour on a tiny rock in the San Francisco Bay. Any thoughts?
Alcatraz is wild. I came in thinking it was a spooky old prison where Clint Eastwood made a movie, and I'm walking away feeling like a full-on energy vortex of history, trauma, and a banjo-playing ghost.
Right? It's not just a prison. It's a symbol of power, punishment, isolation, protest, and maybe unfinished business, literal and spiritual.
It's weird to think how many layers are packed into one island. You've got hardened criminals, violent uprisings, a lighthouse, a Native American protest movement, and now guided tours and gift shops. That's a whole lot of ghosts per square foot.
Okay, but real question? Jeremy, you and me, one night in cell 14D. No lights, no phones, just you, me, and whatever's down there. Think we'd survive?
I think you'd last about 5 seconds. You'd be sitting in the truck and I would be locked in that cell because you know you would lock me in there.
Absolutely.
Never let me out because you'd never come back.
Did you let me bring matches this time?
No, you're not burning down Alcatraz. You couldn't even do it anyways.
Probably not.
You'd probably abandon me and run for the boat.
Damn straight. All right, Conundrum Crew, it's your turn.
We want to know, have you ever been to Alcatraz? Did something weird happen? Or maybe you've visited another haunted prison, Eastern State, Mansfield Reformatory, maybe even something local.
Send us your haunted prison stories, DM us, tag us, or email us at totalconundrum.com. We'd love to feature your experiences in a future listener episode.
And don't forget, head over to our socials and vote in the poll. If you had to spend one night alone in a haunted part of Alcatraz, would you choose cell 14D? The hospital wing, the warden's house, or a Capone's shower concert.
As always, make sure to subscribe on YouTube, leave us a review on Spotify and Apple, and share this episode with someone who loves true crime, history, or ghost stories.
We've got even more twisted tales coming up your way, so hit that follow button and stay locked in with Total Conundrum.
Until next time, keep your eyes open, your banjos tuned. Keep on creeping on. We love you.
Bye. Thanks for hanging out with us here at Total Conundrum. Please make sure to check out our website and blog at totalconundrum.com for news, upcoming events, merch, bloopers, and additional hysteria. You never know what will pop up, so be sure to follow along. If you want to show your support for Total Conundrum and gain access to all of our bonus content, please visit our Patreon page. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The links are available in our show notes. If you have any questions, comments, recommendations, or stories to share, please email us at contact@totalconundrum.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate the love. Keep on creeping on, mother cluckers.